Okay, this is our first webinar in our second strand, in our second series. Today's topic is introduction and overview of RTI. We have with us John Hintz from the University of Massachusetts, and we're very glad that he can join us. A quick reminder to everyone to please use the chat box if you have any questions during the presentation. I'll move that up a little bit. And also, the recording of today's webinar will be available on our webpage, and I will post that in the chat box in just a minute. So at this point, I will pass it over to Dr. Hintz. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Molly. Good afternoon, everyone. As Molly said, my name is John Hintz, and I'm currently a professor and the director of the School of Psychology Programs at the University of Massachusetts. I want to thank the New York State RTI Task Technical Assistance Center, and particularly Dr. Jancic, Teresa Jancic, for inviting me back here again this year. I did some workshops some years ago over in New York when the effort was just getting off the ground, and it's nice to come back and see follow up and see how things are going on in New York. Also, I always like to give a shout out. I'm a graduate of the public schools of New York, so I grew up in Peekskill, New York, down on Smith Street, and moved out to the Lakeland School District when I was a youngster and graduated from Walter Panis High School some years ago. So it's always nice to come back and reconnect with some folks from New York. So as I said, I'm currently the director of the School Psychology Training Program at University of Massachusetts. For the last number of years as well, I have been associated or affiliated with a number of different federal centers that have been exploring RTI and progress monitoring and interventions. And you can see one of them on the first slide there. That center is actually now closed, but the website is still active, and that was the www.rtiforsuccess.org, and that was the National Center on Response to Intervention. It was a federally funded center by the U.S. Department of Education. It was a five-year project. We are now the National Center on Intensive Interventions, and many of the same things that we started to do with the previous center has continued on. So I'll give you I would encourage you to go up and look at that website and also our Intensive Interventions website. Oftentimes for folks who are just embarking on RTI and trying to figure out some of the tools and assessment techniques that might be needed, there's a number of different tool charts on there that are probably the most activated things on the website, so I'd encourage you to go on there. I'd just like to give a brief background on my how I got into RTI and some of my experiences. I've been researching various forms of curriculum-based measurement and progress monitoring for the last close to 30 years now, starting in the late 80s. Back then, there was not too much use for things like curriculum-based measurement. We certainly didn't have things like Ames, Webb, and Dibbles, all those kinds of assessments out there. And I became interested in the assessment of reading, particularly how we develop CBM passage probes from reading curricula. Slowly that morphed into things like Ames, Webb, and Dibbles. I was one of the original collaborators that did a lot of the psychometric work on the Dibbles or on the Ames Web features. And so fast forward now 20 some odd years, and now we have RTI. So my goals for today, and I think this strand is a four-part series, and I believe I'm doing three of the four, but my goal for today is to give kind of an overview of some of what we think are the critical aspects of an RTI model. Bear in mind that the presentation is designed for a broad audience, and I realize that there will be particulars in the state of New York. I think, as I recall, you use a three-tier model versus a four-tier model. So my main goals are to kind of go over some of those critical aspects of RTI, particularly as it appears to assessment. There are a lot of slides here today. I don't know if I'll get through all of them, but some of them, if you come back on the progress monitoring workshop, will also we'll use some of those same slides as well. So with that kind of as an overview, let me begin. I think it's always somewhat important to to talk a little bit about some of the historical aspects of RTI, because I have to assume that at some level, folks that have kind of patched in today or have assumed some leadership roles back in their school. And oftentimes you're posed with questions from your colleagues about what RTI is. And if you don't have some of the fundamental understandings behind RTI, it's oftentimes hard to answer those questions in a way that makes sense to your colleagues. And then what happens oftentimes is that RTI, and it seems like just another kind of initiative that's come down from the state that we have to do in order to appease the state. But in this case, I think from my vantage point, there's some critical historical aspects of RTI that really help make sense when we're trying to explain it to our colleagues. If we roll back history back to PL 94-142, which was the predecessor to IDEIA, it's the first time that we see federally codified this notion of learning disabilities from an educational definitional standpoint. And this is really, if we trace it back to RTI, this was our starting point, was this these new students who had been probably in our schools for a long time, that we started to see and recognize that appeared to have average cognitive and intellectual functioning, average IQ, yet we're not meeting the demands of our educational curriculum. Certainly, there had been other definitional aspects of these folks before, particularly from camps like the Orton Dyslexia Society and people who looked at maybe a more dyslexic approach to things, but it was the first time that the federal government began to codify and recognize these students as being within the public schools. And as we know them now, is children with learning disabilities. And we were not given too much guidance on how to operationally define or assess those students. And as you know, the definition has not changed too much over the last 30, 35 years. And basically, the notion was here that we had children who had average intellectual functioning but were not meeting academically at a level commensurate with that level of functioning. And not to give given too much guidance on that, practitioners, we as practitioners started to operationalize that with the kind of measurements that we had available. One being the IQ assessment, which we still have many of them today. Back in that time, and I was just, I began my career as a school psychologist right in 1982, we really just had two, but one of them was Raining King, that was the WISC-R, and we still had the old Stanford-Binet form LM back there as well. So we had the WISC, and then we would try to operationalize things like achievement discrepancy with things like the old RAT, the Wide Range Achievement Test, the PIOT, which I have to believe was the original kind of EASL test. We saw after that the KEBC and some other forms of measurement. And we used that, and that served us well for about 30 years or so. This original notion, I'll come back to through the slide, or at least the concepts in the slide in a moment. This original notion about learning disabilities is this notion of unexpected underachievement. Okay, so when we use these two tools, and as I said, they served us quite well for 30 years, we started to identify students, place them in special education, but very quickly we saw increasing numbers of students being placed in that category of learning disabilities. One of the things that we know now, though, is that there's a number of problems, or at least potential problems, with that approach that we didn't know about at that time. And these three bullets here are certainly not exhaustive, but I think exemplify some of the issues that may have led to the over-assessment of children with learning disabilities. One is that there's, still today, this debate as to whether or not the IQ test that we have at our avail measure intelligence. And this is kind of an interesting notion here, because if we look as someone, although this is not my main area of focus, I do keep abreast of the literature because I think it's a very interesting phenomenon. And it's a reified construct in the sense of that we can't get a blood type on it. We can't go in and find where the IQ gene is. But what we've done is develop a number of tests that we think to serve as proxies for this notion of intelligence or cognitive functioning. What I think is very interesting about this is as well is that if we look cross-culturally, all cultures have some sense or notion of what intelligence is. So if we looked at the Aboriginal tribes of Australia and asked them, do you have a word that you use to define this construct of intelligence? They would tell us, yes, we have that. We definitely have that. And then if we ask them, how do you measure that? They wouldn't tell us, well, we have this test that has 10 subtests, a number of different factor indices, things of that nature. It would probably be things that were relevant to their culture. So the debate still reigns is, do the tests that we have necessarily measure intelligence, and are they culturally sensitive? One of the things I think is interesting over my career as a school psychologist is that the number of IQ tests have increased over the years. As I noted before, originally we just had kind of the main two, the Binet and certainly the Wechsler scales. But those have grown over the years to, at any one point in time, we might have 8 to 10 different kinds of intelligence measures that we might like to use. What I think is also interesting about that is that anytime we have a new one come out on the market, and part of their validation process is that they correlate their new measure with one of the old measures as part of a concurrent validation process, and they usually come up with very strong correlation coefficients, which begs the question to me then, if the new one, which is purported to be much better than old standards, correlates so strongly with original ones, usually the Wechsler scales is the gold standard, why do we need the new one as a replacement for old ones? So, and I guess some of the answer would be that we're something within the subtest scores, the factor scores that they're looking at, things like that. But this nature of intelligence is debatable, and yet it's been relatively stable across a number of different intelligence tests. The second point that I think is important, and particularly one because we use discrepancy analysis oftentimes, or had during that time, to identify students with learning disabilities, is that the discrepancy score between the IQ test and the achievement test, those two scores, may be less than accurate than we actually believed. And this was certainly the case back in the early 80s, even more the case when I was first a practitioner, when those two tests were not co-normed. And this is one of the growth points that we've seen in recent with recent vendors in developing these kinds of tests, is that oftentimes the achievement and the intellectual portion of the test are developed by the same company, and that they have a co-norming sample, or at least a subsample of the original norming group that the two things are validated on. But the problem still holds, and that is that that score might not be as accurate as we think. So if I could give a quick example, if we have a student with an IQ of 100, and we know that the test has a reliability of 0.95, and that's probably somewhere in the ballpark with the Wechsler scales, and think the full scale IQ is about 0.94 to 0.96, depending on what age range. And then we have an achievement test as well that has a reliability of 0.95. And if I were to ask most people what is the reliability, and if we use the scores on those two tests to get some estimate of a discrepancy, let's say in one case we have the IQ is 100, and in the other case is the achievement score is 89, and I ask someone what is the reliability of that different score, in this case being 11-point difference, most folks would say somewhere in the 90s. Because, 0.94 or 0.95, because each one of the tests themselves had reliability in that range. And what we now know is that that's simply not the case. The actual reliability of the different scores may be down as low in the 0.7s, again, depending on what measures that we're using to derive that discrepancy score. And the way that happens is because when I gave those first two reliabilities, while they're fairly high in the 9s, the balance of that is error, and the problem with error is that unless it's systematic, and typically that's not the case with these measures, it's random, and we never know which way that it's operating at. So that original 11-point discrepancy might actually be very minimal, maybe 2 or 3 points, or maybe not a discrepancy at all, or it might be even larger than we thought, 15 or 16 points. And this is based on this notion is that the reliability of that different score, is not equivalent to the reliability of the individual tests. What results in that then, if we're using those tests for making decisions, is that we're going to make errors in our decision making. In one case, we might say, well, this looks like a significant difference. It's pretty big, when in fact it might not have been as big. And it's likely that that child might get warrant some specialized services and perhaps might take the place of another and not particularly need them perhaps and take the spot of someone else who needs them. Or we might miss children by saying, well, this is not a discrepancy, it's not large enough. And when in fact it might have been the difference between that, the intellectual function and the achievement test might have been a lot larger, but we failed to see it because of the inaccurate estimate of that discrepancy score. And I said the big problem here is we never know which way the unreliability, if you will, is working because it's random. So we don't know. Sometimes I give my students in class an example. I say if a class starts at 1 and you know that my phone is rung just before I came into class, I might come in at 1:10. On the other hand, I usually show up to class about 15 minutes early. I get all set up, and if everyone's sitting there and paying attention and it's 12:50, I'll get going. So when class starts will vary anywhere from 20 minutes, 12:50 to 10 after 1. And the same thing on the back end, too, as well. I might end early if I've come to a point and I don't have anything more to talk about, or I might go a little bit after because I want to get through some slides and finish a point. So that the actual time might never, ever be the same, okay? The last point then, too, and I think this is the most important, one of the most important points, is that the discrepancy or that process that we originally used for many years was based on what sometimes Thomas Hare from Harvard University has coined as the weight-to-tail approach. And I suspect a number of you have heard about this. And this weight-to-fail approach basically means, I'll go into a little bit more detail, that oftentimes it's a responsive model in that we have to wait for children to fail before we can provide them the kinds of services that they need. And I recall back to days when I was a practitioner in New York, and I worked in the Elmira City School Districts for a number of years, and then Monticello just briefly before I went back to graduate school. And I can recall about, oh, it's about that spring parent-teacher conference, about that time every year, particularly in first grade where we might have a child who was struggling somewhat with reading or some other area, but I'll use the example of reading. And we felt that perhaps, you know, give them time, give them the time of the year, and let's see if they catch on. Let's see if they kind of have that epiphany and kind of the light bulb goes on. But now it's the spring, and we have a mom or a dad or both sitting down in front of us, and we have that uncomfortable leaning where we have to say, you know, it's been a long time now. It's about over 100 days here, and your child is still struggling and struggling mightily now to read. And one of the things that might have been recommended at that time would be let's do a psychoeducational evaluation to see if they qualify for services. So people like me would run out and give a bunch of tests and perhaps some other folks too as well. And then we go and we sit down at our table and we whip out all our protocols and we'd sit down and kind of talk to them and describe all the scores on the normal curve. And finally someone would ask the question, well, do they qualify or not? And let's say in this example, again, I have a child with an IQ of 95 and, standard scores on a reading test of, 84 or so. The likely answer to that question would probably be no at that time, at least in my experience. 11-point discrepancy wasn't enough. And we would kind of all be a bit defeated, and we'd close up our file, and we'd say, well, let's see what happens next year. Oftentimes, that child would end up on kind of a retesting list, and then the same thing would happen in second grade as well. And we'd run back again, and we'd all give our tests, and we'd open up the protocols and look at them. And again, unfortunately, that discrepancy wasn't large enough. And we, again, feel a little dejected, fold up our folders, come back, repeat the process again. And then magically, somewhere between third and fourth grade, all of a sudden that discrepancy got large enough that we're able to qualify, if you will, that student for specialized services or special education. Now, what's happened here is not the case that, you know, the child has had some learning disability percolating in their blood and kind of waiting to to flourish in full. What's happened, as you probably know, if anyone who's given these tests, is that the IQ tends to remain relatively stable at that point in time, and that most of the achievement tests are developed on what we call a powered basis, meaning is that the tests start off with a couple questions that are fairly easy, and then they get harder and harder. If they're reading word lists or passage reading and the like. And that indeed, as the child, if in fact they're struggling, gets older and they're given more difficult material, they struggle with it. And so their scores do go down. So finally, at around that age of 3 or 4, oftentimes it's around 8 or 9, we have enough of a discrepancy that children, that child would qualify. And if we look at some of the federal data as well, about 50% of students who are receiving special educational services under the learning disability criteria receive that diagnosis at about that time, somewhere around 3rd or 4th grade, right around the age of 9. So it's an interesting thing. If I'm a policy wonk down in Washington and I'm posed with this problem, someone says, fix it, I do away with that grade. I go kindergarten, 1st, 2nd, 3rd, 5th. But you know that wouldn't be the correct solution here. What's happened, as you know, is there's a psychometric problem. And it's a problem with the tests that we use and the tests that are wedded to the kind of operational definition that we have, so that we can't get that child, although we might have been able to do it using other means. But from a definitional perspective, it's very difficult for us to get that child services without that discrepancy. Probably the bigger problem with that is that we know now from developmental academic literature, is if we just get that child now in 4th grade and it's the first time that we start to try some remediation or specialized forms of instruction, it's probably not likely that we're going to get them back on a trajectory so that they look like their peers. And it's not a nice thing to say, but it's what we know now from some longitudinal assessments. Our studies. I'm often pointing to the work of Connie Jewell, and that's J-U-E-L, who had a number of students in Texas some years ago in 1st grade, and they're developing some reading, some screening measures in the area of reading. As part of the validation process, they had just tons and tons of screening scores on these children in the area of reading in 1st grade, and they followed up with them a couple of years later as part of the validation process. And kind of an interesting thing happened. Those students who were struggling in 1st grade and who were in schools that said, okay, there's not too much that we can do about it, when they followed them up in 4th grade, those children were still struggling, but now struggling even more mightily, and the gap had grown even more so. And that's what I was going back to before. When that gap gets that big, it's hard to close it in its entirety. Interestingly, though, there are some children who were screened in 1st grade that went to schools that used the data and said, hey, let's think about what we can do for these children now before they continue to struggle or struggle even more. And when they followed up with those students, they were, most of them, about 90% of them, were much like their peers. So it gave us a powerful information about what are some of the advantages of early intervention, and particularly this notion of kind of like critical periods. So there are the critical periods for, if you remember back to our developmental psychology days, there's critical periods for things to be taught and for children to learn, and if we miss those periods, it might be difficult to reteach later on. So reading and this notion of that definitional aspect and this notion of wait to fail is something that we finally realize just doesn't make sense with children with learning disabilities or children in general who are struggling with early reading or early literacy skills early on. What this has resulted in now is if we look at toggling between two computers now, if we look at some of the data, and I could extend this out now too, is we've seen a very large increase in the number of students who are being served under that definition. And in fact, about of all children in this country receiving special educational services, about 50% of them receive them under specific learning disabilities. And if I was to look on this left hand, I don't know if you can see my cursor or my mouse, I doubt it, but on the left side of this graph, you can see the largest explosion in identification was right after PL 94-142 into the early 90s. And in fact, I was a school psychologist during that time, and that was a main part of my job was child find, was to go out and do the assessments. beginning in the early 90s, then we see a pretty steady increase in the number of students who continue to receive that label. And I'm glad to report that within the last report to Congress, last two, we've begun to see a downturn in that beginning. And I'd like to think that it's a result of the changes in IDEA and the call for newer other aspects of assessment, particularly those of RCI, but it's simply correlation at this point. But I can't help but think that maybe some of that had some effect as well. The other thing, too, is if I was to extend this curve out without the more recent data and send it down to some friends down at the CDC in Atlanta and said, what do you make of these data, and took off kind of the markers on the X and Y axes, they might say, well, I don't know what you're measuring here, but it seems to be an initial kind of explosion or whatever it was, and we're seeing a steady increase there. And if you extrapolate another 20 or 30 years, you might be posed with overwhelming numbers of people who have whatever this is. And then we certainly don't want that for education as well. So why do we think then that RTI is a useful alternative assessment paradigm for students? Well, one, RTI attempts as an alternative framework for looking at that unexpected underachievement that I noted earlier. But the important key here is that it attempts to use the curriculum or that which a child is being exposed to as part of the basis for making that decision. Second bullet says it eliminates poor instructional quality. Perhaps that's an overstatement, but at least it attempts to address the instructional quality and that what a child's being taught in their classroom. And if I think back again, or if we think back again to kind of a typical assessment model with an IQ and maybe some achievement tests and any one of another number of tests, the working hypothesis is that any child who's assessed in that manner is that they're all receiving an equal education, or at least equal educational exposure in the same form of instruction. Now, you might be saying, well, how can you assume that, John? Well, if we don't directly attend to it, then we're assuming it's a constant and that everyone gets the same. And you probably, I know, can agree is that that's certainly not the case. I know in my the state I work in that certainly there's differences in the educational quality that children get from town to town or one end of the state to the other. Oddly, I live in Connecticut, work in Massachusetts, and so I kind of follow what goes on in two states, and I could say the same here in Connecticut as well. As you probably well know as well, is that part of an RTI model in using it for definitional aspects is that children are identified as needing services or only after they have demonstrated a lack of responsiveness to effective instruction. Okay, so here again is that key aspect that we're using instruction as part of the assessment model. Let me also say here too is that while I've used examples here with learning disabilities here for the first part of today's talk, a main benefit of an RTI model is now that it starts to bridge general education with special education. And I think probably the biggest aspect of an RTI model is that it allows us now to try some modifications within the general education framework that not necessarily were disallowed in previous frameworks, but were not typically tried because we felt, well, if a child's not responding to what's going on in general education, kind of a one-size-fits-all approach, then they must need special education. So it's made us rethink a bit about the role of general education, the role of instruction, the role of curriculum in the learning outcomes for children. And then lastly, and probably most importantly to me, is that it now gives us liberty, a license to intervene early, okay? Unlike in our previous model where we have to wait for that discrepancy to grow, we are now able to use screening instruments to identify children very early on, those that are at risk for developing later literacy or academic problems, and start that intervention process very early on. And again, as I noted before, with Connie Jewell's work, one of the things that we knew from that, and I can cite some evaluation work that I've done around in other states and districts as well, is that when we're able to do that, one of the things that we've now learned is that For a good deal of those students who appear to be struggling early on, many of them respond quite well to early intervention and early exposure to remediation so that they get back on a trajectory and relatively indistinguishable from their peers in a short amount of time. For me, I'm oftentimes asked, well, what is it then? What is it about the RTA model that works? And I think probably it's this, and we've known about it for a long time, is things like academic learning time, opportunities to respond. Most curricula, most pedagogical frameworks are laid out so that the typical child masters it with a certain number of exposures or repeated exposures. And there are some students who just need more. And they're not special education. They're not learning. They don't have learning disabilities, but they simply need more opportunities to respond and practice with the material for them to get it down right. It's not that. And once they get it down, and once they've learned it, they can master other aspects of the curriculum. One of the things I've done for years now is I've been coached football and lacrosse at various levels, youth, high school, and the like. And I know from a coaching standpoint is that for there are many skills and techniques involved in those sports that I know not all players will grasp immediately. Some will get them very quickly and move on. Others that don't, and it's not that they have some kind of disability with respect to scooping ground balls or catching or cradling or blocking or the three-point stance, but they simply need more opportunities to respond than other children, and when provided with those opportunities to respond, are fine and often on their way. So I think that for me, that's the main benefit for an RTI model, is that for the first time, it really places the focus on early intervention and aspects of our remedial process that we can get to children very early on. If at the end of today, someone says to you, hey, what was that webinar about? You say, let me think back. There's a lot of slides. You did a lot of talking. But if you can remember this one little figure in this graph, and I've used it for years now, some people might have seen it, I think you'll understand a lot about what RTI has to offer us. Some of you might, maybe perhaps with older children, might recognize what this graph is in front of you. Those with younger children might not have ever seen anything like this. But what this is, and you can see on the top of that chart, is that it's a height chart for girls. In this case, it happens to be for girls who are white. Kind of the interesting thing about this chart is that it's basic way that a pediatrician would chart the progress of a girl's growth over time. Okay, as I said, some of my older children, it used to be in a manila folder, and I used to see it at the well baby checks, and now everything's computerized, and they have these tablets velcroed to their arm, and you don't ever really see this. You might get a printout once a year where the percentiles are. But what's the interesting thing about this is that the doctor uses this chart basically like we would use assessment measures in an RTI model. And for those who are unfamiliar, what the chart, as you can see on the bottom, has children, in this case girls, age and years, starting at 2 years all the way up to 17. The bottom yellow, bottom red line reflects the fifth percentile. The top one reflects the 95th growth at the 95th percentile, and the heavier medium one in the middle is the 50th percentile. There's a couple other things I think is about interesting about this this chart too, as well, is that you can see that for that most growth for young girls, excuse me, young white girls, is pretty linear, starting from age 2 to all the way up to about, it looks about age 12 or 13 there, right? So that a child at the fifth percentile grows at relatively, and that's the important thing here, relatively the same rate as the child at the 95th percentile, if we look at their slope of growth over time. It just so happens that the two young girls started at different points. All right? So this is a data point, or this is my middle daughter, Tori. It's an older picture, but I always like this one because she looks so cute and cherubic and all happy at that time, and now she's a teenager. It's not always like that. But here is her data point when she was 2 years old, and it's always hard to get them right on the line, but she's always been a bit smaller. She's about the 10th to 12th percentile, somewhere around there. She's like my wife. My wife's about 5'1". I've looked at charts that project her height out until when she's an adult, and she'll probably be about 5'1". But the point here is that if I was a pediatrician, or if I was a pediatrician who used an assessment model that was wedded only to summative assessments, mm-hmm. and this was the only information that I had, I might come to the conclusion that with respect to Tori, that I need to provide some special forms of education, or in this case, maybe some kind of special treatment. Now, why would I say that? Well, she's at the 10th percentile. We can't have that. We need to get her back up to the 50th percentile. As crazy as this example might seem, I might put her on human growth hormone. I might do whatever the case might be based on one simple data point from one assessment. Well, you can probably see where I'm going with this now. Here's Tori's data point at age 3, and age 4, and age 5. I think that's 5. Yes, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and we could continue on. I think that, I don't know if I went any further than that. But now an interesting pattern appears. One, you can see is that she is growing at a linear rate. She's staying right around the 10th percentile. Those data points should be probably a little bit higher, but it's sometimes hard to get there, you know, get them to snap perfectly. But in this case, now the doctor has, the pediatrician has a much different assessment picture. Is she growing? Certainly she is. Does she need human growth hormone? No, she doesn't. Is she responding to the intervention? Yes, she is. Well, what's the intervention in this case? Well, she's being well cared for. Her basic needs are being met. Her emotional needs are being met. Her other needs are being met. She might not agree with that all the time, but they basically are. And she's responding to the environment. Doctors might say she's thriving. Okay. A different picture, though, would be painted if, after those first initial data points, 2 or 3, that her data points started to taper off and fall below that 5th percentile, then we begin to question what's going on here. Then it would be a time where we'd want to call in for intervention, or perhaps a specialist. Right, the doctor might say, "Well, I'm kind of a garden variety pediatrician. We need to call in a specialist right now," and that's basically what an RTI model tries to do. It attempts to use initial data as screening. If I backed up any one of these data points, beginning with the first one's a screening assessment, right? That's a screening assessment, that's a screening assessment, and so on and so forth. And these are kind of like your benchmark assessments in an RTI model that we do 3 times a year, fall, winter, and spring. How does a child stack up relative to their peer group right now? And that's one important aspect of assessment, is assessing how a child is doing relatively to some peer group or peer norm or standard, right? But the second decision that we can make with these types of data are what we call formative. And I know you as teachers probably know a lot about the formative assessment. But in a formative sense, or sometimes it's called an absolute sense, in this case we're only concerned with Tori's growth over time, irrespective of some norm standard, we can see that she's actually growing and responding to being cared for. All right. So this notion of using data both from a screening perspective to make decisions about a child's relative standing to peers, and then also using those data to be able to make determinations about a child's growth and development over time are key aspects of RTI. And basically what we're doing from an assessment perspective in RTI is very similar to what the doctor's doing here as well. The major difference is being, again, we're using academic data. The doctor's only getting one data point a year, which we usually call for the use of 3. But when applied then to an RTI model, the way that we operationalize that is what we call a dual discrepancy approach. And the dual discrepancy means is that you have to have 2 discrepancies. One, in this case, let me say as well, if this was an academic situation, it might not call for the need of particular need for academic intervention. She appears to be growing. She's responding to the intervention. Her data points are going up, right? She's perhaps below her peers, but she's responding to the intervention. Sometimes people think that RTI frameworks will open the floodgates for anyone who's below benchmark now is going to qualify for services. And if this was a data pattern that we were seeing, that would not be the case. Here would be a child that who's clearly responding to the core curriculum, if you will, or in this case being well cared for. But in order for children then to be considered as warning special education, they need to be discrepant with respect to that initial status data point or the screening assessments and their rate of growth over time. And that "and" is a critical thing here. What it provides then is that a heterogeneous sample that says we can have students who are perhaps below on screening measures, but then are responding to the curriculum over time, who might not warrant special education or likely don't. They might need additions to their general education or modifications to the general education curriculum, but here are children that can continue to grow and thrive without the need for special educational services. So if you can keep this in mind, this is essentially what we're trying to do, and hopefully some of you have experiences with that in an RTI model. This is just a logic model describing what some of the core features then of RTI is and what should we expect out of there. As you can see, this is a logic model is a standard way of putting together a program. If I look across the top, the standard features are that you always have inputs, activities, outputs, outcomes, and impacts. And if we look at the inputs, there are a number of critical aspects that we have to attend to in an RTI model. One is that we have to assess or evaluate our instruction and determine whether or not it's effective or not. The instruction needs to comes in three different types, as you can see here in activities. We need to assess and think about our core curriculum. That is it a scientifically based core curriculum? Is it meeting the needs of the children of our district or our local area? We need to have supplemental interventions for those children that that are not responding to the core curriculum, but not only slightly so. And oftentimes these supplemental interventions, as we'll talk a little bit more, are kind of standardized. And then we also have to have more individualized interventions for those children who continue to under-respond to both the core curriculum and supplemental interventions. We need to have procedures for progress monitoring. And this is usually one of the first things that newer adopters look at is what are we going to use for our universal screening and monitoring. And shall I say as well, too, is that if I go back quickly, one of the nice examples here, too, is that the same instrument that's used for screening and the instruments that are used for screening and progress monitoring are the same. They're not mixed and matched. So that when we go to compare, if we go to look at both status at any one point in time relative to the benchmark screener and progress over time, and if we're using the same instruments to do that, those both, which systems like Ames, Webb, and Dibbles do, then we're comparing apples to apples. If, however, you're using one system for benchmark screening and a separate system for progress monitoring, it's very difficult or impossible for us to be able to determine whether or not this dual discrepancy model, that is, a child might be low relative to one of the assessments, like a screening assessment, but might be responding, like in this case, well to a progress monitoring, but we might not know if that's an artifact due to two different assessments. So for those of you who are looking for assessments, or suggest that you implement assessments that where they have both the screening and progress monitoring forms available within the same assessment suite. And then we have to have a playbook, if you will. If I was a coach here, we need to have a codified way for making decisions. That's those are things like, how do we identify students at risk? And then how do we identify when students are effectively responding to the intervention? And some of that we'll get into in later workshops as well. In fact, we will definitely with the progress monitoring aspect. If we have our inputs and activities going on and they're well-developed and they're being delivered with integrity, we should be able then to quantify the number of students who are responding to the core. We should be able to quantify children's changes in rates of learning over time. We should be able to quantify the number of students who are moving through various tiers, and then as you follow out there, we can do all kinds of analyses on these data. One of the things that I forgot to mention earlier when we were talking about that that graph that had the increasing numbers of students being identified as SLD over time, is that in some of our evaluation or my evaluation activities with different districts around the country, what we've come to find is that with a well-implemented RTI model, probably about over a 3 to 5 year period, we should expect to see about a 50% reduction in the number of students who are being or request for initial evaluations for special education, right? For in this case, usually specific learning disabilities. And then over time, we should probably see about a 25 to 50% decrease in the number of students who are current at any one time being served in special education under the SLD label. And sometimes people think of that when they hear that, say, well, you're just denying services to children who probably need them. And in our analysis, that isn't the case. Actually, what we found is that because we're getting to students early on, in those grades, again, of kindergarten, first, second, third grade, they didn't look different in fourth grade than they would have if we hadn't intervened early on. They might have looked like students who had needed specialized services come fourth grade or the age of 9 or so, but these children look characteristically different now. So they don't need to require those services, and they usually are getting by just within the general education curriculum as well. Some of those evaluation results have been replicated too in published studies, and Matt Burns at University of Minnesota has one of those as well. There's reported on those as well. But I think that's one of the other benefits too of an RTI model is that over some time, it's kind of like putting money in the bank. I know it's a lot of effort early on, but about 3 to 5 year period, you should start to see that the numbers of resources that you have to deploy for those children, if they were all in special ed or all needing, has been lowered over time, which gives you frees up other time and other resources to provide to other students as well. So that kind of gives us a whirlwind tour of RTI and kind of the historical aspects. All of it is based in a preventative model, which we'll talk about here in just a moment. Our approach to RTI, and I know this might vary with your state. In fact, I'm pretty sure it does, as I recall. Our approach to RTI is in a four-tier model, and this is what we train. Now, let me tell you, the fourth tier, for those of you who are wondering, what's that fourth tier? For us, is special education, okay? So special education falls in that fourth tier. As I recall, in New York, you have a three-tier model, and special education is not part of the tier structure. And if someone can confirm that for me by, on the chat box, that would be helpful. But the reason I like to put special education in that fourth tier is because it sends the message, if you will, that special education is indeed part of the model, okay, that it is there. It happens, and it's represented by a tier. In instances where it's not, what I've seen at times is that, okay, we go through the three tiers, and we'll talk a little bit about that in some detail in a moment, and then if a student is still unresponsive to the kind of services and assessment and intervention that goes on in the three tiers, they might find themselves in special education, at which time they may not continue to use the same similar assessment strategies particularly formative assessment strategies that we know are very effective in those previous three tiers. So what I'm saying here is that it could be the case is that once a child could get really good formative assessment and progress monitoring for half a year or so as they move through tiers two and three, and could be making instructional decisions based on the data that are coming in. And then if a child then goes into special education, and for whatever reason, the special education system in the school says, well, we don't do progress monitoring over here because we're not part of the tiered system, some of the benefit of formative evaluation and progress monitoring could be lost in that situation because you wouldn't see it in the special education. So I see some, Teresa's right, New York State does not mandate the number of tiers. So there's strong preference for three tiers. Let me say, too, that that's not uncommon. A lot of states have done that, particularly early adopters with RTIs, because the original models oftentimes had three tiers in them. And I'll show you the ubiquitous triangle, which you've probably all seen here in a moment. And the triangle itself points towards a three-tier model. I have my own triangle I'll describe when we get to that here in a moment. So you will find many different approaches to doing, probably three of the most common I've seen, anywhere from three to five. At one time, the state of Georgia had a five-tier model. But the number of tears might vary. You might also, if you look to the literature, see how risk status might vary as well. Typically, schools use universal benchmarks to do that, and I think that's probably the most common. But sometimes you see districts use a combination of both the universal benchmarks and progress monitoring over a short period of time to determine whether or not a child is in need of tier two or intervention services early on. We employ what we sometimes call a commercially available manualized intervention in tier two. And what does this mean for us then is that we typically do not do individualized types of intervention in tier two. The reason originally for this decision for us were that we found that the decision making was more parcimonious in doing so, rather than sitting down and going through a problem solving model or a problem solving conference for each student. As originally developed, folks like Dan Reschle and Dave Tilley and other folks said, you at tier two you probably have two different kinds of things. You can use this structured, or what some they call the structured protocol approach, which is kind of what we call a manualized intervention, or you can use a problem-solving approach. And some of the research that came out early on from that is that most people adopted a problem-solving approach as something that was very familiar, particularly with school psychologists and training at that time. But what we found is that when we sat down and talked about each child who came out as needing some tier two intervention out of their benchmark screenings, not much individualized came out of that problem-solving process. In fact, most of the interventions looked the same or were the same thing for each child. And if that's the case, couldn't we save time and effort by, rather than having a conference on every child, is simply using our data, our color-coded data reports, to quickly assign children who are in tier two. The other thing that we found here now is that this is an area where curriculum developers have responded quite well to the needs of RTI. So many, for example, Scott Forsman, Houghton Mifflin, other curricula developers have developed remedial activities that go along with the core curriculum. Oftentimes these are leveled, and oftentimes these are reinforcement of the main concepts and activities that were taught in the core curriculum. So it's much easier then for us to assign children to that level of intervention and start them right in. What we found in our evaluation results is that this works. It works for about 3 out of 4 children who come into tier two. Now the key is catching them early on, but that kind of one-size-fits-all approach is fairly effective. I mean, probably a good example for those who are Scott Forsman users know that City Streets is the core curriculum, and Sidewalks is that tier two intervention that we use there that comes in 4 levels. And we found that that's fairly effective. Again, about 3 out of 4 children respond positively to that intervention. Now, why is this the case? We tend to think it's because the issues or concerns with children at tier two, when we get them at the right time, aren't that individualized. They typically are struggling with very very similar aspects of the curriculum. And if we provide them with kind of standardized intervention, it meets the needs of that of those children. In some ways, I think of this, I know I've used the example in the past of educational amoxicillin. I don't mean to thumb my nose at the intervention here or even education, but there's a reason why amoxicillin works for quite a wide variety of, inner ear infections and the like. It's because they're quite common. Many children get them, and this kind of a one-size-fits-all intervention approach works well with them. I think probably the reason why, again, children are responsive to this tier two, this kind of one-size-fits-all approach, is that it's the increased opportunities to respond. These are children who, while they make some success in the core curriculum, need that extra boost that the remedial portions of those curriculum provide them in tier two. And once they're able to do that, they get on to, they're able to master the core curriculum. In tier three for us, this is where we use more individualized problem solving. These are children who are under responsive to tier two. At this point in time, we typically do some individualized assessments. I'll talk a bit about some of the things that we use in one of the other webinars. but we use more different types of diagnostic assessment to try to be, now we're starting to get the sense that children at tier three is that perhaps there's something individualized about their response profile here. There might be specific skills or gaps in the learning profile that need attended to, and good assessment and then good intervention designed on that on the basis of that assessment will help us start to design interventions that are more targeted to their specific needs. Oftentimes, the interventions in Tier 3 for us look like the kinds of instructional tactics and components that might go on in special education. And I know sometimes it's very hard to get a read on people when you're doing this in front of a computer versus live. But sometimes I get a response from people when I say that, and I usually follow up by saying that special education doesn't own the techniques. What special education is a legal protection to access to those techniques. But things like direct instruction, strategy instruction, cognitive strategy instruction are all things that many children benefit from that we can use in those in that tier three. And I'll talk more about that too as well in another webinar here about how we use the information from tier three to perhaps start thinking about is this a child who's going to be able to meet the demands in the core curriculum with additional, maybe intensive support, or do we start to think about this as a child who might need some special education support? We define response to intervention two ways, via slope. That is how children grow over time, and we do that again by measuring their response to intervention through our progress monitoring data. And then importantly as well is where do they end up at the end of intervention too as well. And basically we use our benchmarks for doing that. Okay, so a typical chronology for students maybe at this time of year for us is that they've gone through their benchmark screenings back in, sometime in September, first week in October. We try to do them in September. For students who are struggling or below benchmark, they've been in Tier 2 intervention now for a number of weeks, and we've progress monitored them once a week in the area that they're receiving support in. And then at the end of about 9 weeks, 9 or 10 weeks, at our next benchmark, which will come up after the holiday break, we'll sit down and make answer some questions about their response to the intervention. We'll look at their slope information over time, and we'll say, okay, have they responded? Are their data points going up? What is the actual slope? And if we have using a measurement system where we know the slopes of typical peers, how does the student's slope of progress compare to other students at that same time? And then secondly is now with the benefit of added intervention, what growth have they made into the next benchmark? That would be the winter benchmark. So we use those two pieces of information to help us determine whether or not we need to continue the intervention, if we can move a child back into tier one, or if we need to move a child back into tier three. And if you think about it, essentially we have four profiles that come out there. The nice blue sky profile is here we have a child who made nice growth and has now hit their benchmark standards, right? Typically, those children will go back into tier one. Oftentimes, they might be children, too, who are just kind of straddling that line between tier one and tier two. Secondly, we might have a student who still does not hit the benchmark, but who's making really good growth. In fact, their growth might exceed that of their peers. And typically our decision at that point in time is that the child here is really responding, let's continue what we do, and come back to them again in the spring benchmark and see if they continue the growth. Oftentimes those are children who are straddling the other line, who are between, kind of the more yellowish, if you will, the darker yellow or brighter yellow, if you will, on that tier two framework, started lower on that tier two benchmark. We keep them in tier two because the data from our progress monitoring suggests that they're doing quite well. Then we'll have students who have continue not to hit the benchmark, but who are just below the slope, or who are continuing to grow or respond, but whose slope of improvement is not fast enough or great enough that it compares to other children at the same time. Unfortunately for those children, if they continue along that trajectory, that gap will get larger and larger. Typically, those are children who we would recommend move into tier three and more individualized forms of instruction, and we would continue to monitor them. And then lastly, there are those children who continue not to hit benchmark and who continue to not show or evidence significant rates of improvement. And those are children who we might say move down to a tier, or if they're in tier three, in fact, might be the time that we start to think about special education or eligibility determination. So that kind of gives you the framework of the decision making. You'll notice too is that in each one of those examples, we allow the intervention to breathe, if you will. We give it about an 8 or 9 week period. One of the things that we found is that educational or academic interventions, unlike some behavioral interventions, we don't see immediate change. So when we first started doing this, using these approaches, we would start to look after 2 or 3 weeks, and if children weren't responding, we might start to think about altering the intervention or changing things. And what we've come to find is that we probably didn't need to do that. These things do take some time, and about an 8 to 10 week period is about as much as we need to. We know we're pretty confident, if given that amount of time, we'll be able to see some progress, true progress, in fact. Yeah, or true responsiveness, in fact, that it's occurring during that time period. And then lastly, under-responders, as I just finished off with, may go through a comprehensive evaluation to answer questions regarding things like learning disabilities, perhaps behavior disorders or mental retardation. And typically at that time, MR is usually a rule out, and most oftentimes has been assessed well prior now to this process. So that kind of gives you a framework for the way that we use our model. I keep on hitting the down arrow when I got to come over here. When I think about RTI, oh, I see we're starting to, do I have the time right here? I'm going to go for another couple minutes. We think about RTI is that we essentially have to have three really big portions in here, and I talked about some of these. We need to have an assessment system. That assessment system has to have features of periodic universal screening, continuous progress monitoring. We need to have an instructional system, scientifically based core curriculum, tier two and tier three interventions. And then, as I noted before, we need to have that playbook. And once we have all those three things occurring, we have a good operational system of RTI. If any one of these or parts of these are missing, then it's very hard for us to determine, have a good model. So oftentimes, for example, it wouldn't be uncommon when I first started consulting with districts is that they would have their screening up and going. They'd identify students who are in tier two or need to tier two services, but hadn't given thought to what was that going to look like instructionally in their schools. Or they might not have methods determining when a child, in fact, is responding to an intervention and when should we move a child from tier two to tier three. And without those pieces in the model, it's very hard to implement fully. This all leads us to, as I was saying before, is that RTI is based on a multi-tier preventative system that's basically is built on a public health model of prevention, primary prevention, secondary prevention, and tertiary prevention. And I know you've probably all seen this, and in a well-operating RTI model, what we have then is about 80% of our students responding affirmatively to our core instructional procedures. We might expect at any point in time about 15% of the students who might need some type of tier two intervention or might need more opportunities to respond to the material in order to succeed in the core. And then we also might find anywhere from maybe 5 to 8% of the students who are really what we sometimes call as our critical care children, and those are our children who really typically need specialized forms of instructional services, oftentimes in special education. If I were to redraw the triangle, and I don't because I don't want to confuse people, but I subdivide the yellow. I have in between the yellow and the red, I have an orange for a four-tier model. And that's basically because my daughter told me if I mixed red and yellow, I'd get orange. But that's that third tier to signify that we're going to have children moving between tiers two and tier three. And also the other thing I typically take out is the hard lines in between each one of those, and they're more blurred. And that's just to signify that we can have children who can go between those tiers, and that it's not as hard and fast as we oftentimes think. And we can have children moving between tiers during a year, or crossed years and the like. I think I'm going to defer to here to Teresa. Should we stop here and I can pick up with some of this other stuff at the next, because we're starting to move into progress monitoring in tier one. So I can stop here if you think that's appropriate. Because I know I have 5:07 and I think we're supposed to go for an hour, correct? I see someone typing away. It says thank you. I see a note coming up. Thank you for attending the webinar. Please take a few minutes to complete a brief survey. Okay. Yeah, so this is a good time to break. I think it is too. Let me say for folks who are going to come back to the second or third portion, what I'll continue with, many of the slides I sent to the center knowing that people might not be able to attend all three. So what you have in there are some slides from some of the other presentations. What I'll do is in the next presentations, I'll pick up with progress monitoring benchmark screening and pick up with some of those slides. I know people are probably signing off, but if you have some questions now, you can type those in. Molly says, thank you for attending the webinar. You can read. I don't need to. But I'll stay logged on as long as the center has me logged on if people have questions. On the first slide, you have my email. It's hints@umass.edu.edu. You can feel free to email me there, although we are going into finals week, so it's a little busy. First, this is the last week of classes, actually. We start finals in the next week. But in your experience, are schools triangulating their benchmark data with classroom data that may be more formal in nature? So I can read the question and then answer it online, answer it verbally, right? I don't have to type it in. I think that's the case, so I'm going to do that. So Teresa asks, in our experience, do schools triangulate benchmark data with other types of classroom data, such maybe in more formal nature, such as running records? Yeah, that's certainly the case. We certainly see schools use a variety of screening assessments in their three times a year, running records being a common one, the Fontes and Pinnell system being another one too as well. And I see no problem with that, other than at some point in time you do have to pick which assessment you're using as a primary for making decisions about tiered intervention. The only other way to do it, if you have someone on staff, is to create a regression approach where you have all your different assessment, your assessments, plug it into a statistical equation, weight each one of the assessments, and then figure out on the basis of the multiple assessments who are those children who need tier two intervention. My experience too as well is that some of the other types of assessments that you might see in schools were not designed to make relative decisions between children. Okay, so for example, the running record, while it's a very good, or I think a good formative assessment and one that can be used to assess absolute growth over time, it wasn't really developed or intended to make these kinds of fine decisions about, or relative decisions across children. So typically what I suggest to folks is that pick one or maybe two that you're using for making the relative decisions. Use the other assessments to develop your intervention strategy if, in fact, you're using a problem-solving strategy in Tier 2. But rely on those ones that were explicitly developed for making relative decisions in Tier 2 Tier 1 for making your screening decisions. I hope that answers that, your question. I see that there's a registration link there. I see another question coming in. So it should pop up here in just a second. Here it comes. If a student in Tier 3 is responding favorably to treatments, including test modifications, smaller, more intensive grouping, is that evidence that the child should have an IEP? Okay, that's a good question. Brief question with not a lot of info, but I'm interested in your answer. Okay, so this is going from Brian. So that's a really good question, Brian. So oftentimes what we will find is that children in Tier 3 will come in probably two different flavors, if you will. They are students who, there are some students who the intervention in Tier 3 provides that aha moment, okay? And I'll use my older daughter as an example here. I mean, and when she was in first grade, and, I think going into second, it's hard to remember back that far, but she had some struggles in math. And she was placed into, I know, an instructional or a remedial math group in that first year. And then the second year was placed in an even smaller one, right, which way I would kind of equivocate with Tier 3 here. And she stayed in there for the year, and then she finally got it. She's struggling with the base 10 system, basic operational functions and the like. And once she got it, and she got it through that intensified intervention, she was fine to go back into general education, and actually she's done quite well in math here. So there's some students for whom the Tier 3 intervention provides or reemphasizes or teaches the skills that were missing, okay? And if that's the case, you might see some of those students be able to go return back into Tier 1 with into Tier 1 with tier 2 levels of support. So that's kind of one. The other child that I think you're referring to, and which we oftentimes see in Tier 3, is a child for whom we provide some intensified interventions in Tier 3. We see that they make some progress, maybe not great progress, but they're responding positively. We might pull those out for a bit and see that they start to struggle again. Those are the types of children who we oftentimes think that will need those specialized forms of instruction on a more long-term basis. And if that's our suspicions, those are typically oftentimes the children we start to think about an eligibility determination for, because what special education does, or what that assessment does then, is protect the child's long-term access to those instructional techniques under the auspices of special education. It's a kind of a funny and different way of thinking about special education. It's actually kind of like a legal protection to access those interventions over the long term. Because without that, if they were just kind of a general ed Tier 3 student, you could pull them out at any one point in time based on just about any reasoning. So oftentimes that Tier 3 gives us some insight into the level of need and intensity of the intervention that the child might need, and whether or not we think they're going to need it on a long-term basis. And if we think they do, then we might move into an eligibility determination. So I hope that answers your question. That was a good one. That's a good one, though. But we do see some students, perhaps, where there's just basic skills or broken links that need to be retaught. And once they get those, they're fine. You more oftentimes see those in math than literacy, probably, too, as well. I thought I saw another question coming in, but maybe they pulled back on it. Okay, I see Teresa's typing in. So I think we're going to end there. It looks like that's the sign-off from Teresa. I saw that the registration for next week's webinar is up, so if you'd like to do that. Otherwise, thank you for coming in today and listening to me. I don't know. I can't tell. I often wonder, was there anyone from Peekskill or Lakeland School District there? But again, a shout-out to my folks down at my friends in New York. Keep up the good work. And, again, thank you for coming in today. I know this is a very busy time of year for all of you. So, and hopefully we will you'll join me on webinars 2 and 3 as well. I'm going to hold on here a minute because I do see some other people. Oh, there's a picture. Trisha lives in Lakeland. See there? I grew up on Route 6 right behind Lou's Corner Store in Roe Park. So, but I was a Walter Panis guy. So thank you. Thanks, Pat, for writing in. All right. So I guess, Teresa or Molly, I stay here until you sign me out or you tell me when to sign out, and then we'll reconvene next week.
John, it's Molly. I think we're good. People are signing out, and great job tonight, and we'll talk to you next Monday.
Okay, I kind of got my speed there. I was staring at myself at a computer screen for a little bit. It is a little weird, but so okay, great. So I will. You know what? I might use part of these slides. So can I send you different slides if need be toward the end of the week for Monday?
Sure, sounds good.
Okay, very good.
Have a good
night.
Night
then.
Okay.
Okay. Bye bye.